Ask open your Bibles this morning, book of Joshua, Joshua chapter 23, at the end of Joshua there, Joshua 23 this morning. We're going to read and think about the ending of this Old Testament book in our time together today, Joshua 23. Welcome to our visitors. We're glad that you are here today. You encourage us with the gift of your presence. We hope that we have similarly encouraged and edified you, built you up in the worship that we have been offering to God here this morning. If you've never been here before, we'd like to know what brought you our way and how we can encourage you and help you on your way this morning. If you haven't filled out a visitor's card, feel free to do that before you leave today and stick around, talk to us a little bit. Let us get to know you and let us share a little bit more of ourselves with you. We're glad that you're here today. A little bit of housekeeping this morning as well before we get started here. We're getting well settled into the fall now, getting into our fall routines, and that means our fall gospel meeting is almost here. Our gospel meeting starts 3 weeks from today. That's hard to believe, October 15th. 3 weeks from today, it'll be October 15th through October 18th. That's a Sunday through a Wednesday, starting 3 weeks from today. Roger Schaus from New Albany, Indiana. New Albany's a suburb just across the river there from Louisville, Kentucky, but technically in Indiana. And Roger Schaus will be with us. Roger preaches for the Charleston Road congregation, which used to be the old Silver Street congregation, which was a church I did my summer training program with way back when I was younger and had more hair. They don't know me anymore up there. Don't recognize me. Look completely different, as my kids point out from my wedding pictures sometimes. But Roger's going to be with us. Roger's a good man. Roger is a great Bible student and a wise man. He will bring us good lessons from the Word of God. And so I hope that you will make your plans to be here that Sunday through that Wednesday as much as you possibly can. And again, if you want to bring a friend, a neighbor, coworker with you, I think that would be good as well. And there are flyers available for the meeting. There are flyers available in the back foyer. They're only available in the back foyer right now. We don't have any on the side tables yet, but you can get these in the back foyer and put that on your own refrigerator, not to mention maybe give one to somebody you think might be interested, able, and benefit from coming to this starting 3 weeks from today. All right. Well, for decades, Joshua had known the land in which they now rested. After all, a generation or two before, he had been one of the first 12 Israelite explorers of this good land that God had promised to Abraham and was now finally giving to his people. A land that was a stark contrast to Egypt and the desert once you got very far from the Nile. It was a stark contrast from the wilderness in which they had lived the previous 40 years. The other 10 spies, 40 years before, the other 10 spies and the nation as a whole could only see the giants in the land. They couldn't see the prosperity, the beauty, or the potential. They couldn't see the promise of God and what was at hand. All they could see was the giants. And so they blamed God in their frustration. They rebelled against him, and they paid with their lives. 40 years of wilderness wanderings, which Joshua still himself had to endure, even though he personally had played no part in the rebellion, because sometimes the righteous have to suffer with the wicked and because of the wicked. And so Joshua himself has to engage in the 40 years of wilderness wanderings. And then at the end of those 40 years, the torch is passed from Moses to Joshua and to a new generation. And the conquest takes place, and the bulk of the book of Joshua tells the story of their entering the land. They're conquering the land. And then in those chapters that are flyover country in the book of Joshua, of the tribe-by-tribe division of the land within the families and clans that make up each tribe. The other chapters of the book we never read. But they're there, and it's interesting because the land mattered to the people. And page by page, even those chapters that we find almost as boring as the genealogies, if we're honest, are anything but boring, because what they do is they reveal the level of care where God places each family and each clan in the land that he has promised centuries before. It may not matter to us, but just as surely as you will know how the survey of your property is properly guarded. Which is why whenever we buy or sell real estate, even to this day, we survey the property. It mattered to them because this was their inheritance. This was literally God's gift to them, not just to the 12 tribes, but to family by family within the tribes. This mattered. This was God being faithful from the greatest to the least, being faithful to the people whom he had brought out of the womb of Abraham. But now when you get here to chapter 23, chapter 24, it's the end of the line for Joshua. He is now 110 years old, almost as old as Moses, but not quite when he died. And now, like Moses before him, it is his time to die. And like Moses before him, he gathers the nation together for one final speech, one final lesson. And so if you have your Bible, in chapter 23 and verse 1, we'll read here for just a little bit this morning. It came about after many days when the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies on every side, and Joshua was old and advanced in years, that Joshua called for all Israel, for their elders and their heads and their judges and their officers, and he said to them, I am old and advanced in years, and you have seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations because of you. For the Lord your God is he who has been fighting for you. See, I have apportioned to you these nations which remain as an inheritance for your tribes, with all the nations which I have cut off from the Jordan even to the great sea toward the setting of the sun. And the Lord your God will thrust them out before you and will drive them out before you, and you will possess their land just as the Lord your God promised you. Let me stop right there real quick and just tell you what he's saying. What he's saying is, and this is a detail we often overlook, Joshua in the conquest of the land did not literally take every last bit of the map of Israel that's in the back of our Bibles. And there's a reason for that. It was actually foretold by Moses back in Deuteronomy chapter 7. Back in Deuteronomy chapter 7, Moses told them as they go into the land that the Lord your God, Deuteronomy 7 verse 22, the Lord your God will clear away the nations before you little by little. You will not be able to put an end to them quickly, for the wild beasts would grow too numerous for you. But the Lord your God will deliver them before you and will throw them into great confusion until they are destroyed. And so literally what happens, what the book of Joshua depicts, which is, by the way, why sometimes some people wonder what's going on in the book of Judges when there are still nations to be defeated in the land if Joshua led the conquest. Joshua establishes Israel's hegemony over the region. They're in control of it. It's very much like, for instance, it's very much like when the United States goes into Iraq back about, what was that, about 14, 15 years ago. When the United States goes into Iraq, we establish our control over the region, but does that mean that every last pocket in the region is under our control? Well, no. There was still Mosul, and there was still Fallujah, or however you say that in Arabic. There were still these other places that were not directly under our control, even though we had the hegemony over the whole region. Same thing happens at Joshua's day. Joshua and Israel establish hegemony over the region. But what happens is, and God told this in Deuteronomy 7, what happens is there weren't enough Israelites in those days to completely occupy the land. And so what they do is they defeat the nations in the places they most immediately settle. And then as they are fruitful and multiply in the years to come, then God will continue to drive out nations as they claim more and more of that land directly for their people as they are fruitful and multiply. That's what's going on. Even after all these years, even after Joshua has led them and God has been with them, there is still going to be more to do. Because part of the lesson, ladies and gentlemen, is that for the people of God in this life, there is always more to do, even when God is with us. And God will drive them out when the time comes, when the people are ready, when their numbers multiply. God will drive them out. Just give him time and just have faith in him. Be faithful to him. But God will still be with you. And when the time comes, those nations will be removed as well. And so Joshua says, basically, I've done it. We have lined out the land. We have surveyed the land. We've lined it out. We've declared what everybody's inheritance is going to be. In verse 5, the Lord will thrust those remaining nations out before you. He will drive them out before you. And you will possess their land, just as the Lord your God has promised you. So, verse 6, his edification statement, his encouragement, his exhortation to them. Be very firm, then, to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, so that you may not turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left, so that you will not associate with these nations, these which remain among you, or mention the name of their gods, or make anyone swear by the name of their gods, or serve their gods, or bow down to their gods. But you are to cling to the Lord your God, as you have done to this day. For the Lord has driven out great and strong nations before you. And as for you, no man has stood before you to this day. One of your men puts to flight 1,000, for the Lord your God is he who fights for you, just as he promised. So take diligent heed to yourselves to love the Lord your God. For if you ever go back and cling to the rest of these nations, these which remain among you, intermarry with them, so that you associate with them and they with you, know with certainty that the Lord your God will not continue to drive these nations out from before you, but they will become a snare and a trap to you, and a whip on your sides and a thorn in your eyes, until you perish from off this good land which the Lord your God has given you. And that's the story of the book of Judges. We'll pick up and we'll continue all the way until Israel is removed from the land into exile at the end of 2 Kings. Joshua repeats God's words that have basically been given to him at the very beginning of his leadership role and what he encourages Israel to do as he's about to pass from the scene. Up to this point, they've been obedient. This is not a criticism by Joshua of the people's faithfulness. Up to this point, they've been faithful. This is a reminder that as he leaves, they must continue to be faithful. God's promises have not failed them. Just as God has blessed them, however, he can and will fulfill his curses and his warnings as well. But here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen. Whether it's people of Joshua's day or people of our day, people like the blessings. We love the promises, but we don't like to listen to or like or remember the warnings and the consequences. We love the good stuff. We skim, we skip, we rationalize away. We don't hold ourselves accountable to the hard stuff. And so there are four quick observations I want to make with you this morning. Four quick observations that I think are relevant and important for us to remember. Four constant risks to the people of God. Four danger zones. Four principles for us to remember, lest we as God's people attempting to inherit the land and hold the land that God has given us, not a physical, geographical space, but literally the life of God through Jesus and the hope of eternity in God's presence, that promised reality, that eternal promised land, as we attempt to take and to hold our inheritance. Joshua's words of both encouragement but warning as well, those words can still have resonance and meaning for us today. I want to talk with you about four quick observations in a few minutes that we have this morning, and we will be done. There are four risks that are always there. There is always the challenge of inheriting and holding the land, of inheriting the full measure of God's blessings and God's promises, which now we know is not a place but God's eternal salvation in Jesus. The first of those is this. Number one is living in fantasy land. Is living in fantasy land. Of having unreal expectations. See here's the challenge. Here's the dilemma sometimes. Sometimes we say to ourselves, well, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing for God. And I'm being obedient, and I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And so everything in life is going to go well. And I want you to notice that one of the things, again, that I've just emphasized, that Joshua says to them as he leaves the land is, you've been obedient, you've been faithful, God has blessed you, and you are in the land, but there is still work to be done. There is still hard work to be done. It's not always going to be easy. There are still nations that are going to have to be dealt with. There is still spiritual risk and temptation you're going to have to face, because until those peoples are removed, their gods are still going to be in the air, so to speak. You're going to hear their names, you're going to see their practices, and there's going to be a temptation to absorb what they do and who they are. There's going to be a temptation to let your son marry their daughter because he thinks she's pretty. Remember the story of Samson? What's going to happen in just a few decades down the road when Samson, his parents say to him, when he wants to marry that Philistine girl, it's not a good Jewish girl, it's not a good Israelite girl you can marry. No, he says, she looks good to me. Get her for me. There's still going to be struggle. There's still going to be temptation. Nowhere in the Bible does it ever say, whether it's Israel in the Old Testament or Christians in the New Testament, that just because we do what we're supposed to be doing, and even though we've had success, and even though God has been faithful and has blessed us, nowhere in the Bible does it say that the work ends. The Bible, in fact, is quite clear about the exact opposite, whether it's Joshua's speech here or New Testament testimony later. The Bible is quite clear, cover to cover, that things in this life are hard. And so we shouldn't be surprised, nor should we be caught off guard, nor should we be naive about the fact that the struggle is real. Because God has been explicit and upfront about this, that to be God's person requires constant vigilance and dedicated hard work. And that's the way it always has been, and that's the way it always will be until we rest safely in the eternal promised land when Jesus comes again, or we die and leave this age. We stop thinking about why at the very beginning, when you go back to Joshua chapter 1, and God has to repeatedly tell Joshua to be strong and courageous. Why does God have to do that? I mean, Joshua's a good man, been faithful back in the book of Numbers with a whole generation that's been dead. Joshua was faithful back then. He's been faithful 40 years in the wilderness. Why does Joshua still need courage? Because to continue to serve God is a challenge. It's hard. And even though Joshua's got decades of faithfulness to God, God says to Joshua, you're not done yet. There's still work to be done. Be strong and be courageous and get on with it. From the very first pages, the Bible explains that life in the fallen world in which Satan is on the prowl is tough. But too often, ladies and gentlemen, we prefer to live in the fantasy land. We prefer to focus on the promises and the enjoyment of them. And there are lots of religious false teachers throughout the centuries and even today and even in this city. Lots of false teachers who will gather large crowds around themselves by telling people how to basically make heaven on earth. Rather than recognizing that what God tells us is there will never be heaven on this earth. Heaven is outside this earth in this age. But it's so much easier to focus on the promises rather than the perils. We prefer to live in a fantasy land. Let me ask you something about, when we stop and think about it, even within the limited scope of our own lives and the more mundane things, stop and think about the danger of unrealistic expectations. You ever had an unrealistic expectations or realize once you're involved in something that your expectations were unrealistic? You ever go on a vacation and it didn't quite measure up to what you're expecting? You ever get there and the hotel just doesn't quite look like what was on the website or in the brochure? Or is that just me? Oh, man, and I have stories. We can talk about our honeymoon. We can talk about some of the trips we've been on over the years where back in those days it was a brochure. And what you got when you got there wasn't quite what you looked like on the brochure. I remember we went on our honeymoon. It was a lovely place. It looked great on the brochure. We were excited when we got there. And it was a little rental house in a neat little town. And we were going to go do some sightseeing. We were going to have a great time. But once we got there, we discovered that the actual owner of the property lives in an apartment above the house on our honeymoon. And that he has a staircase that comes down by the window by the bedroom. And that he likes to wander around in the wee hours of the night because you can see the silhouette on the window as he goes back and forth. That wasn't in the brochure. Not quite what we expected. Great story now. We can laugh 20 years later. I was investigating concealed carry laws in Arkansas at that point. No. But that's the thing. We expect certain things in life when we go into them. And then what happens when the expectations don't measure up? Well, then we get disappointed. And then we get frustrated. Some people go to college and it's not their expectation. Or they, when they go to college, they realize that what they always thought they wanted to do in high school years was not what they really want to do when they find out what the course is actually involved or when the internship actually happens. I have a friend of mine who's a cardiologist now who grew up wanting to be an architect. But once he started hanging around architects when he got older, he realized he's not going to be drawing his dreams. He's going to be building other people's dreams. That's not what he wanted to do for the rest of his life. So he went to med school. You ever start a new job and you have different expectations? Because that's how it works in jobs sometimes, isn't it? We're both on our best behavior. The company's on their best behavior. I'm on my best behavior. And then we get together and the expectations for the position are not what you expected. Or all of a sudden after 6 months or a year, what you're doing anymore is not what you signed up for. Or this gets a lot more serious is what happens in marriage and family. I think too often too many young people go into marriage expecting Hollywood's version of the reality, which is not real. And people go into marriage, especially young people, thinking it will be perfect, some sort of permanent state of bliss. You find your one true soulmate, and it's nothing but puppy dogs, rainbows, and unicorns. People don't ever think cancer can happen to them. People don't ever think that financial problems, job loss, investment failure, business failure, will happen to them. They never think that they're going to marry somebody who snores. We need to learn what Josh is trying to get Israel to understand is that faithfulness to God does not mean that life is going to be ideal or easy. We need to learn, ladies and gentlemen, that the ideal is not a certain form of life, a certain status or a certain situation of itself. What makes life life and what a healthy way to approach life is that we hold on to the person, the relationship, instead of the situation. In other words, we savage our spouse sometimes because they don't live up to our ideal picture of what we thought our husband or our wife would be when we got married. And when we discover after the first week that they're not perfect, we wonder about what we've done or who we've married, and we blame them. And the problem is not them. The problem is most likely the fact that we were unrealistic. We had false ideals. Because we'd rather preserve the picture of perfection that we had in our head than accept the person for who they are. We do that in marriage. We do that in parenting, too, sometimes. Yes, there's a place in parenting where we mold and we grow and we shape and we develop our children. But sometimes we, if we're not careful, we go into parenting with a certain vision of who our kids have to be. They have to be the academic All-American. They have to be the athletic all-star. They have to be the musical virtuoso because that's maybe what we were. Or we want our dreams to be fulfilled in them and we put pressure on them rather than accepting them for who they are. We torture them, whether we realize it or not, with their all-too great awareness that they are not who we wish they were. We always forget that the picture is posed. In the era of digital photography, we keep on taking the picture until we get the one we want. And that's the one that goes on the wall. But that's not life. And if we forget that, it will kill our marriages. It will kill our children. It will kill our career when we bounce from job to job and opportunity to opportunity because nothing ever measures up to what we wanted. And it will kill our relationship with God as well because we expected unrealistic things that God never promised this side of eternity out of God right here and right now. It will kill our relationships in the church because we get disenchanted with the fact that the elders aren't perfect, the preaching isn't always excellent, and our members aren't always there for us the way we wish they were. So we'll go to the next place looking for perfection. Until that place inevitably disappoints us as well. And we either give up or we move on again. The kingdom of God, the Bible tells us, is both now but also not yet. It is here, it is now. It is every bit this side of the cross, Jesus working through his church in this world. But the full perfection of the kingdom and its consummation, all its glory, all its perfection, sin dealt with, Satan destroyed. Oh, that's not yet. And so the Hebrew writer reminds us in Hebrews 11 and verse 13 that so many of the great people that we read about in the Bible died in faith without receiving the promises. Abraham died without the perfection God had promised him. Noah died. David died. All the people you think about in the Bible, all our great heroes of faith, they die without seeing the full coming of what God had promised. Abraham never got everything God had promised in this life. But what Paul makes very clear is that through Jesus, Abraham now has everything God had promised, and so much more than Abraham could ever have imagined. And the Hebrew writer in Hebrews chapter 11, for all some familiarity, sometimes we need to remind ourselves really of what the Hebrew writer is saying. What the Hebrew writer is saying is that those great people, those men and women of God, were commended for their faith because, as one person put it, they understood that this life doesn't have to be perfect for God to still be faithful. And so God has told us up front, this is how life will be, even for Christians, even for Israelites. Even in the days of Joshua, for all their faithfulness and obedience, there were still going to be struggles ahead they had to be ready for and faithful in. And so too do we. But number two, the second thing I want you to think about for just a little bit with me this morning is one of the other risks for the people of God besides just kind of living in an unreality, of living in a fantasy land, is number two, that we forget that we forget things that ought not be forgotten. Back in Joshua 23, go back and look again. Look again at what Joshua says there, verse 12 and 13 and 14. For if you ever go back and cling to the rest of these nations, that haven't been dealt with yet, but God will deal with in time when he's ready and you're ready. If you ever go back and cling to the rest of these nations, these which remain among you and intermarry with them so that you associate with them and they with you, know with certainty that the Lord your God will not continue to drive these nations out from before you, but they will be a snare and a trap to you, a whip on your sides, thorns in your eyes, until you perish from off the good land which the Lord your God has given you. Now behold, today I am going the way of all the earth, and you know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one word of all the good words which the Lord your God has spoken concerning you has failed, and all have been fulfilled concerning you, not one of them has failed. And it shall come about that just as all the good words which the Lord has spoken to you have come upon you, so the Lord will bring upon you all the threats until he's destroyed you from this good land which the Lord your God has given you. When you transgress the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them, then the anger of the Lord will burn against you. You will perish quickly from off the good land the Lord has given you. But what's interesting is what happens next. After this strong warning on the part of Joshua, what he does then in chapter 24 is he gives them a history lesson. Part of God's formula for faithfulness is focus on the past. And so Joshua then, the last thing that he actually does before he dies, is he gives them a history lesson. And it's out of that history lesson, verse 24 of Joshua 24 then. The people said to Joshua, we will serve the Lord our God. We will obey his voice. And so Joshua made a covenant with the people that day, made a covenant, or made for them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. And Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God, and he took a large stone and set it up under the oak that was by the sanctuary of the Lord. And Joshua said to the people, behold, this stone shall be a witness, shall be a reminder against us. For it has heard all the words of the Lord which he spoke to us, and it shall be a witness against you that you will not deny your God. And then he dismissed the people, each to his inheritance. We don't, for sake of time this morning, go all the way through Joshua 24, but Joshua tells them the history of who God is and what God has done. And the reason Joshua goes through this long history is because then, like now, we tend to forget. We tend to forget. Joshua goes through this history and sets up a stone as a marker, as a reminder. The same reason we set up monuments. Washington, D.C. is full of them. We put up monuments to remind us of our past, of who we are and how we got here, and therefore of the values that define us as a people. Memory is crucial to a people's faithfulness to their heritage and to their identity. And it's no different in the church than it is in a secular nation. And so Joshua, and really God through Joshua, go through the history because they know people are prone to forget. And when people forget, people become just like the world. They become just another part of the world. And so what happens, even if you turn a page to Judges chapter 2, sure enough, the text tells us. And Judges 2 and verse 6, when it rehearses this part of the story for another generation, that when Joshua had dismissed the people, the sons of Israel went each to his inheritance to possess the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. In other words, as long as it was a living memory, a generation that had gone through it, a generation that went through World War II remembers certain things. A generation that goes through war remembers certain things. What happens in a country that hasn't seen war in multiple generations now? Well, we're finding out. Because we forget who we are and what holds us together. And so it worked. And so it worked even in ancient times, and that happens in religion as well. When they got comfortable, when they were settled, when that generation that had seen what God had done was gone, what did they do? They forgot. Verse 10, and all that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who didn't know their history anymore, who forgot the stories. And forgot that the stories weren't just facts for a test that was what annoys us about history. We don't like the facts and the figures and numbers. The stories were a definition of who we are, how we got here, and what God wants. And there's nothing too new about that, ladies and gentlemen. That's still the peril for people of God today. I forget yesterday's answered prayers and blessings because I'm overwhelmed by today's problems. I forget what God has done in the past because I'm so focused on the present and my concerns and my needs and my fears in the present. There's a reason in the Old Testament God had them set up pillars and keep the Passover and come back to Jerusalem several times a year. And ladies and gentlemen, there's a reason that even today, God still has us come together every week, and as the central feature of our worship, gather around the table in which we confess to each other what happened in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago on a cross and in a tomb 3 days later. Because the people of God depend for our very lives upon our memory of what God has done. We think that the Bible stories are just for our kids to capture their imaginations when they're young, and we get older, we just move on to straight abstract morality. We need the stories as much as the kids do to remind ourselves of who God is, of what he's done, and what he therefore is yet to do when Jesus returns with his angels in flaming fire. When we forget, several things become possible, none of them good. When we forget, sometimes we become fearful. We become fearful because I don't think about the stories often enough, because I don't know them well enough. I forget that the same God that I pray when I'm sick, the same God that I pray to when I'm in trouble financially, the same God that I pray to when I'm concerned about my marriage or my kids, that same God that I pray to today, here, is the exact same God who parted the sea, the exact same God who sent fire from heaven, the exact same God who dwelt on earth in the temple in Jerusalem, the exact same God who became flesh and dwelt among us in Jesus of Nazareth, the exact same God who raised Jesus from the dead on the third day, the exact same God who made himself visible in tongues of fire upon the apostles in the day of Pentecost, the exact same God who in the person of his apostles worked miracles, the exact same God who speaks to me in the Word, even right here, right now, today. That's the same God I pray to when I'm concerned, when I'm afraid, when I'm in doubt. If it doesn't lead to fear, sometimes what happens when we forget God's stories and when we forget to think about God on God's terms, when we lose sight of our spiritual heritage, sometimes it's not so much fearless, it leads to arrogance. When everything is going well, you know what happens? We quit praying. When everything is going well, we quit praying. And even worse, when everything is going well, we begin to think that what God actually did, we did. We blame God for the problems of life, but we take all the credit for the successes. How is that? And yet here was Moses, even before Joshua, here was Moses warning the people of God not to forget God, not just in the hard times, but even more so not to forget God in the good times. And so in Deuteronomy 8, Moses warned them in verse 14 that when everything that you have multiplies, your heart will become proud. And you will forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of slavery, out of Egypt, who led you through a great and terrible wilderness with all the serpents and scorpions, the dry ground where there was no water. You'll forget the God who brought you water out of the rock. You'll forget the God who fed you with manna in the wilderness so that he might humble you and test you, probe you, refine you, to do good for you in the end. You'll forget. What you'll begin to say in your heart is, my power and strength of my hand made me this wealth. No, you shall remember the Lord your God, because it is he who gives you the power to make wealth. When we forget, if we don't fail in fear, we become arrogant in our self-righteousness. And we begin to give ourselves credit for what God and God alone has done and for what God and God alone has made possible. But number three, the other thing that happens for the people of God as we get comfortable in the land, as we get comfortable with what Jesus has done for us, as we get too comfortable with the cross and with salvation and with our own sense of relationship with God. Well, the third thing that the book of Joshua reminds us is a danger, is a risk, is that we become satisfied with the way things are. We become satisfied with the status quo. Again, back in the book of Joshua, chapter 23. Look again, verses 6 and 7. Then the Lord your God, he will thrust out these remaining nations. He will thrust them out from before you, drive them out before you, and you will possess their land, just as the Lord your God has promised you. And so be very firm then to keep and to do all that is written in the law of Moses, so that you may not turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left. But what the book of Judges tells us happens with those remaining peoples is this, if I can paraphrase loosely what Judges 1 and Judges 2 describe, that eventually the people found it easier just to leave the nations there even as they expanded. It was easier just to leave them there than to go fight any more battles, drive them out, and push on to the perfection that God offered them. It was simpler just to leave things alone. I've got mine. I'm happy. I'm content. Why go on the road again? Why risk life and limb in battle? Why leave my family? Why go and do this when I've already got mine and I'm fine? And there's a complacency, ladies and gentlemen, there's a complacency that can settle into those who have become too comfortable in their salvation. It happens for us today when we begin to say, you know, I've been walking with God. I've been doing what I'm supposed to be doing for all these years. I've been faithful to God for all these years. That, you know, I deserve a break. I deserve to coast a little bit. I have a right. I should be able to take some time off. Or rather than going on with what God has fully offered us, we begin to rationalize ourselves and our current spiritual status and our own remaining worldliness by comparing ourselves to somebody else. We can only find somebody else who's weaker or more wicked than we are. And so we compare ourselves to others, and we like what we see. And since we can always find somebody who we're doing better than spiritually, we'll say, this justifies me. I'm already ahead of the curve. I'm already further down the road. I can afford to coast now for a little bit. Ladies and gentlemen, we need to understand this morning that the issue that God has with us when that kind of a mindset of mediocrity sets, and the issue God has with us is not that we are not perfect. As the psalmist puts it, he remembers our frame. He remembers that we are but dust. God does not expect the impossible of his creatures. The issue that God has is when we become complacent in mediocrity, when we become content to allow the remaining nations, the remaining sins, the remaining temptations in our lives to stay where they are because we've come far enough and we've done enough. The issue that God has with us is not that we are not perfect. The issue that God has with us is that we quit growing, that we quit struggling, that we quit pushing on with the subtle and the secret sins that still lie within our hearts and sometimes within our lives. And so instead of pushing on towards maturity, to pushing on to what's possible for God in our lives, we switch to a defensive mode, like Israel did in the land eventually. We switch to a defensive mode where we are where we're at, and we're content with where we're at because we've already made enough progress. And so we rationalize, and so we sit back, and so we no longer test ourselves, we no longer challenge ourselves, we no longer are honest with ourselves about who we still are and what still yet needs to change. Because like Israel did despite Joshua's warnings, we become content with the nations that still remain. It's just easier to leave it alone. But as you read the book of Judges, you know how well that worked out for Israel. Eventually, rather than those nations dwelling among them, the book of Judges tells us, it became de facto Israel dwelt among the nations. The sin eventually colonizes us if we're not committed to driving it out completely. So one of the risks for the people of God, number three, is that we become satisfied with mediocrity. We become satisfied with where things are rather than where things should be. And fourthly and finally, very quickly this morning, one of the last things that happens is we become proud. One of the great risks for the people of God and our enjoyment of our salvation, our enjoyment of our foretaste of the glory to come, even today in the church, right now, in the blessings of God, is pride. A certain presumptuousness, even. And what it looks like is this. What it looks like is this. Joshua in Joshua 23, reminding the people that the blessings can still become curses. Even now, even still. If you fall away from God. Just as verse 15 says, just as all the good words which the Lord your God spoke to you have come upon you, so the Lord will bring about the threats. Don't doubt that as much as God keeps his word in blessings, he will not keep his word in the curses. He will. It is the mark of pride. It is the mark of arrogance. It is the mark of presumptuousness that we feel entitled to God's blessing and we demand that God keep his promises while we ignore his warnings. And therefore, we are upset with him when judgment comes. Some of us think that we can play chicken with God. Oh, we wouldn't think that way, but we live that way if we're honest about ourselves. The implication of how we live sometimes is that we can play chicken with God. We expect God to be there for us in trouble. We expect to pray to God and deliver us, but we don't expect God. We don't expect God to hold just as fast to his word, not just be with us, but to also judge us. And so Joshua, before he dies, strongly implores the people whom he loves, the people whom he's led, that they need to obey all of God's commandments, always. That's how to truly inherit God's blessing. That's how to truly be God's people. And that's how truly to live long on the land, to enjoy fully and eternally and permanently the salvation that God has offered his people. And if you're here this morning and you're not yet in the promised land of God's offered salvation through Jesus, we want to encourage you to deal with that this morning. If you are here this morning, you recognize that Jesus, who, by the way, Jesus is just the Greek way of saying his Hebrew name, which was Joshua. Jesus is the leader of God's people who delivers us into the promised land. If you want Jesus to lead you into the promised land of God's eternal life this morning, we'll help you with that. If you are ready to confess that you believe Jesus is the Son of God, with the implication that confession of not just a fact that you accept as true, but of an authority that you will allow to rule over your life, that Jesus is the Son of God, which means that Jesus is Lord. Repenting of your sins, that's your participation in the world, we'll baptize you for the forgiveness of your sins this morning. But if you're a child of God this morning, and your need is to reaffirm your place in the promised land, because the sins in your life, the nations that still dwell in your life, so to speak, use the metaphor of the morning, are now settling you rather than you driving them out. Pray to God for forgiveness, however it is, that you become more like the world again. We can pray with you, for you, in some way, encourage you, hold you accountable, teach you, work with you, whatever your need. Why don't you come talk to us while we stand, while we sing.